loudspeakers. Then the crowd appeared, a deep swell of white faces, upwards of 13,000 by some counts. Onlookers hurled bottles, rocks, piss, and spit down on the marchers. The black demonstrators marched. The white mob pulsed and seethed. And then, something released. Some invisible barrier fell, and the white onlookers lurched forward, crashing down on the marchers. That's when the police fired the tear gas. The marchers returned the next night, and the night after that. They walked the 16th Street Viaduct for 200 consecutive nights. The city, then the nation, then the world took notice. Little changed. A 1967 New York Times editorial declared Milwaukee America's most segregated city. A supermajority in both houses had helped President Johnson pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But legislators backed by real estate lobbies refused to get behind his open housing law, which would have criminalized housing discrimination. It took Martin Luther King Jr. being murdered on a Memphis balcony and the riots that ensued for Congress to include a real open housing measure later that year in the 1968 Civil Rights Act, commonly called the Fair Housing Act. The white, working-class South Side had, since the 1930s, made room for a small number of Hispanic families whose men had been recruited to work in the tanneries. In the 1970s, the Hispanic population began to grow. Instead of putting up another fight, whites began moving out, pushing farther south and west. Poland became Mexico, a small enclave on the near south side of the city. The north side remained black. The east and west sides of the city, as well as the far south, where Lenny's trailer park sat, belonged to the whites. Open housing law or not, Milwaukee would remain one of the most racially divided cities in the nation. Lenny stamped out his cigarette and ducked back into the office, which was situated in the middle of the trailer park, near its only entrance and exit. It was a cramped and windowless space, paper-cluttered and lit by a naked bulb screwed into the ceiling. The old fax machine, calculator, and computer were covered with grease smudges. In the summer, a wet spot grew on the thin maroon carpet under the leaky air conditioning unit. In the winter, a space heater buzzed softly on a plastic bucket. Over the years, Lenny had added some flourishes, stag antlers, a Pabst Blue Ribbon plaque, a poster of a flushed pheasant. "Hey," Lenny greeted Susie as he took a seat behind his desk. Susie Dunn was on her feet, as usual, sorting mail into the mailboxes that made up one side of the office. She was not placing letters in their boxes as much as punching them in there, fast and hard. It was her way. When Susie smoked, she sucked the cigarette down, keeping her hand close to her mouth. She couldn't talk without also sweeping or scrubbing or rearranging patio furniture. It was as if she'd fall over like a toy top if she stopped spinning. Susie's husband liked to call her the Queen of the Trailer Park. Other people settled for Office Susie, so as not to confuse her with Heroin Susie. "Here's your unemployment check," Susie said to a letter. "Now why don't you pay some rent?" "If she don't pay her rent, she ain't gonna be living here much longer. She can move back to the South Side or live in the ghetto." The office door opened and in walked Mrs. Mites, barefoot. At 71, she was a taut and unfrail woman with a shock of cotton-white hair, a face crisscrossed with wrinkles and no teeth.
"Hey, Granny,"
Lenny said with a smile. He, like everyone else in the park, thought Mrs. Mites was crazy.
"Guess what I did today? I threw a bill in the garbage can."
Mrs. Mites looked at him sidelong with her bunched-up face. She had almost yelled the words.
"Is that right?"
Lenny answered, looking at her.
"I'm no dummy." "Well, I've got some bills for you. You can pay mine."
"Ha," Mrs. Mites said, walking out to start her day pushing a grocery cart and collecting cans. Mrs. Mites paid the bills with her SSI check. She cashed in the cans to give her mentally challenged adult daughter snack money or, after a nice haul, a trip to Chuck E. Cheese's. Lenny grinned and went back to his paperwork until the door swung open again. People who got half an ear everywhere else got a full one from Lenny. It was up to him to keep track of rents and maintenance requests,
to screen tenants and deliver eviction notices. But it was also up to him to listen to the trailer park, to know it, know who was current and who was behind, who was pregnant, who was mixing their methadone with Xanax, whose boyfriend had just been released. "Sometimes I'm a shrink," he liked to say. "Sometimes I'm the village asshole." The owner of the trailer park was named Tobin Charney. He lived 70 miles away in Skokie, Illinois, but visited the trailer park every day except Sunday. He paid Office Susie $5 an hour and reduced her rent to $440. Tobin waived Lenny's rent and paid him a salary of $36,000 a year, in cash. Tobin had a reputation for being flexible and understanding, but no one thought him a pushover. A hard man with squinting eyes and an unsmiling face, he had a gruff, hurried way about him. He was 71, the same age as Mrs. Mites, and worked out regularly, keeping a gym bag in the trunk of his Cadillac. He was not chummy with his tenants, or amused by them. He did not pause to ruffle their children's hair. He did not pretend he was anything he was not. His father had been a landlord and at one point owned almost 600 units. All Tobin desired was one address and 131 trailers. But in the final week of May 2008, he found himself on the verge of losing them. All five members of Milwaukee's licenses committee had refused to renew Tobin's license to operate the trailer park. Alderman Terry Witkowski, a longtime Southsider with a pinkish face and silver hair, was leading the charge. Witkowski pointed to the 70 code violations that neighborhood services had documented in the past 2 years. He brought up the 260 police calls made from the trailer park in the previous year alone. He said the park was a haven for drugs, prostitution, and violence. He observed that an unconnected plumbing system had recently caused raw sewage to bubble up and spread under 10 mobile homes. The licenses committee now considered the trailer park an environmental biohazard. On June 10th, the city council, called the Common Council in Milwaukee, would vote. If the licenses committee's decision stood, Tobin would be out of a job and his tenants would be out of a home. That's when the news people showed up with gelled hair and shoulder-mounted cameras that looked like weapons. They interviewed residents, including some outspoken critics of Tobin. "The media paints us as ignorant half-breeds," Mary was saying to Tina outside her trailer. "They said this was the shame of the South Side," Tina replied. Both women had been in the park for years, and both had strong, wind-blown faces. "My son hasn't slept because of this," Mary went on. "Neither have I or my husband. You know, I work two jobs. I work hard. I mean, I can't afford to go anywhere else." Mrs. Mites walked up and put her face right up next to Tina's. Tina took a step back. "That son of a bitch," Mrs. Mites began. "I'm going to call the alderman, and I'm going to give him a piece of my mind. That son..."
"See, but that won't help," Tina cut in.
"I'm going to go, and I'm going to give that alderman a piece of my mind," Mrs. Mites replied. "That little son of a bitch." Tina and Mary shook their heads as Mrs. Mites stomped off. Then Mary turned serious. "And to be told to move to the north side is not funny," she said.
"It's not funny."
She shook a little and broke eye contact to keep from crying. That was the heart of it, what trailer park residents feared the most. When Mary and Tina and Mrs. Mites and the whole trailer park talked about having to leave, what they were talking about was the possibility of having to move into the black ghetto. Office Susie was one of several residents who had previously lived on the north side, where her adult son had a gun stuck in his face. "The alderman said this is a ghetto slum," she vented.
"I'll show you a ghetto."
The situation twisted Susie's stomach so much that her son hid her pain pills, fearing she'd swallow a handful. The trailer park had 10 days before the final vote, so tenants hosted a barbecue for the media, began calling local representatives, and started to recite what they would say to the Common Council. Rufus, the junk collector, with his trim red beard and distant blue eyes, wrote up his comments and practiced. "And then I'll say, who has been behind on their rent, $500? And the hands will go up, and I could keep going, 700, 1,000, and all the hands would go up." Rufus planned to end his speech by saying, "This is no slum lord. This is not a bad man.
If his speech didn't work and the trailer park was closed, Rufus was planning to put a reciprocating saw to the trailers and sell the aluminum. Tobin worked with his tenants. He let them pay here and there. When tenants lost their jobs, he let some of them work off the rent. He would sometimes tell Lenny, "They may be slow paying, but they're good people." He lent a woman money to attend her mother's funeral. When the police picked up the drunks responsible for cutting grass and collecting litter in the trailer park, Tobin bailed them out of jail. Tobin's negotiations with tenants were rarely committed to writing, and sometimes tenants remembered things differently from the way Tobin did. A tenant would say she owed $150, and Tobin would say it was $250 or $600. Tobin once forgot that a tenant paid a year's worth of rent in advance after winning a workers' compensation claim. Trailer park residents had a word for this, being Tobined. Most chalked this up to old age or forgetfulness, though Tobin was only forgetful in one direction. It took a certain skill to make a living off the city's poorest trailer park, a certain kind of initiative. Tobin's strategy was simple. He would walk right up to a drug addict or a metal scrapper or a disabled grandmother and say, "I want my money." He would pound on the door until a tenant answered. It was almost impossible to hide the fact that you were home. It was hard to hide much of anything. Office Susie knew when your check arrived. She put it in your mailbox. And Lenny could plainly see if you had enough money to buy cigarettes or beer or a new bike for your kid, but not enough to pay the rent. When a tenant opened the door, Tobin would thrust out his hand and say, "You got something for me?" Sometimes he knocked for several minutes. Sometimes he walked around the trailer, slapping the aluminum siding. Sometimes he asked Lenny or another tenant to rap on the back door while he assailed the front. He called tenants at work, even talking to their supervisors. When caseworkers or ministers would call and say, "Please," or "Wait just a minute," Tobin would reply, "Pay me the rent." Tobin was not going to forgive and forget losing hundreds or thousands of dollars or settle for half of what he was owed or price a trailer below market value. When tenants fell behind, he had three options. He could let it slide and watch his income fall. He could begin eviction proceedings, or he could start a conversation. Option one was a non-option. Tobin was a landlord to make a living, and if he was too lenient, he could lose his business. But Tobin also did not evict most tenants who owed him. Pushing tenants out and pulling new ones in cost money, too. In an average month, 40 of Tobin's tenants were behind, nearly one-third of the trailer park. The average tenant owed $340, but Tobin only evicted a handful of tenants each month. A landlord could be too soft or too hard. The money was in the middle, with the third route, and his tenants were grateful for it, though often not at first. Jerry Warren wasn't. Jerry used to ride with the Outlaws, a biker gang, and was covered in tattoos, several of which he had acquired in prison. Eviction notice in hand, Tobin had whapped the side of Jerry's trailer, an aqua blue 700-footer Jerry had painted himself. Jerry balled up the notice and threw it in Tobin's face, yelling, "Tobin, I don't give a shit about this fucking eviction. And Lenny, I don't care how old you are. I'll still take to whooping your ass something good." Lenny and Jerry exchanged words, but Tobin was unfazed. He had begun a conversation. And a few days later, after he had cooled off, Jerry would pick it up. He offered to clean up the trailer park and attend to some maintenance concerns if Tobin canceled the eviction. Tobin accepted the offer. He took a different tack with Lorraine Jenkins. A month before the licenses committee had rejected Tobin's renewal application, he had given her a ride to eviction court in the Cadillac. Lorraine received SSI for learning impairments attributed to a childhood fall out of an attic window. Her monthly check was $714. Her monthly rent was $550, utilities not included. Lorraine had been late with the rent several times before Tobin finally took her to court. "It's just hard to give up that rent," Lorraine admitted. "You've got to wonder if the street people don't have the right idea. Just live on the street. Don't have to pay rent to nobody." She sat in the passenger seat, while another tenant named Pam Rinke, a pregnant woman with straight-cut bangs and freckles, sat in the back. In court, Tobin offered them both stipulation agreements, a civil court's version of a plea bargain. If they stuck to a tight payment schedule, Tobin would dismiss the eviction. If they deviated, Tobin could obtain a judgment of eviction and activate the sheriff's eviction squad, with something called a writ of restitution, without having to take Lorraine or Pam to court again. Throughout his fight with Witkowski, Tobin had worried that tenants would hold their money until the fate of the trailer park was settled. But most tenants went right on paying. Lorraine wasn't one of them. Already behind, she had withheld June's rent because she didn't know if the park would be shut down. If she had to move anyway, she figured, she might as well pocket the $550. Lorraine was pushing her luck. Besides owing back rent, she had been one of the critics who had appeared on the nightly news, where she admitted to seeing prostitutes and drug dealers in the park. Phyllis Gladstone, the most vocal supporter of Witkowski, had put Lorraine up to it. When Tobin found out about everything, he recalled that Lorraine hadn't fulfilled her stipulation agreement. That meant he could ask the sheriff's eviction squad to remove her. So he did. Soon, a letter from the Milwaukee Sheriff's Office arrived in Lorraine's mailbox. Printed on a bright yellow sheet of paper was the following message. Current occupant. You are hereby notified that the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office has a court order, writ of restitution, / assistance, requiring your immediate removal from the premises. Failure to vacate immediately will be cause for the sheriff to remove your belongings from the premises. If an eviction is necessary, risk of damages or loss of property shall be borne by you, the defendant, after delivery by the sheriff to the place of safekeeping. Movers will not take food left in your refrigerator or freezer. Remove food items. The words had terrified Lorraine. It showed. Her emotions projected onto her face like a movie screen. When she was happy, she beamed, flashing a gap-toothed smile. And when she was depressed, her whole face drooped as if being pulled down by 100 tiny lead sinkers. At 54, Lorraine lived alone in a clean, white trailer, though she prayed to one day be reunited with her two adult daughters and her grandson, who, along with God, occupied the center of her universe. She was tub-bellied, with a broad face and freckled white skin. Years ago, she had been gorgeous, and liked to dress in a way that made boys lean out of their car windows. Lorraine still cared about her appearance and would leave her eyeglasses at home because she thought they made her look like a dead fish. When she wanted to look nice, she put on jewelry she had acquired as a young woman, using safety pins to expand the necklace chains, so they fit. Smelling of sweat and vinegar, her brown hair in disarray, Lorraine stepped into the office, wringing the yellow paper like a dish rag. After a brisk exchange, Tobin led Lorraine outside and called after Susie.
"Susie! Susie!"
Tobin yelled.
"What, Tobin?" "Take her to the bank, will you? She's going to get some money for the rent."
"Come on," Susie said, stepping briskly to her car. When Susie returned with Lorraine, Tobin was in the office, shuffling through papers.
"How much?"
he asked Susie.
"I have 400,
Lorraine answered.
"I'm not calling off the eviction,"
Tobin said, still looking at Susie. Lorraine owed another $150 for that month. Lorraine just stood there. Tobin turned to Lorraine.
"When can you get me the other 150?
"Tonight, okay?" Tobin cut her off.
"Okay, you give it to Susie or Lenny."
Lorraine didn't have it. She had used $150 of her rent money to pay a defaulted utility bill with the hope of having her gas turned back on. She wanted to take a hot shower, scrub away the smell. She wanted to feel clean, maybe even something closer to pretty, like she used to feel when she danced on tables for men, back when her daughters were babies. She wanted the water to soothe the pain of her fibromyalgia, which she likened to a million knives going up her back. She had prescriptions for Lyrica and Celebrex, but didn't always have enough for the copay. Hot water would help. But $150 wasn't enough. We Energies accepted her money, but didn't turn on her gas. Lorraine felt stupid for paying. Susie made out a receipt on a piece of scrap paper and stapled it to Lorraine's eviction notice.
"You should go ask your sister for the rest,"
she suggested, picking up the fax machine's phone and dialing a number she knew by heart.
"Yes, hello? I need to stop an eviction at College Mobile Home Park,"
Susie said to the sheriff's office.
"For Lorraine Jenkins in W-46. She took care of her rent."
Office Susie had canceled the sheriff deputies,
but Tobin could reactivate them if Lorraine didn't come up with the rest of what she owed.
Lorraine sulked back to her trailer. It was so hot inside that she thought lukewarm water might run in the shower. She didn't turn on the fan. Fans made her dizzy. She didn't open a window. She just sat on the couch. She called a few local agencies. After several unsuccessful tries, she said blankly to the floor, "I can't think of anything else."
Lorraine lay down on the couch, tried to ignore the heat, and slept.
4. A Beautiful Collection. The day the Common Council was to decide the fate of the trailer park, Tobin Charney, dressed in a polo shirt, tan slacks, and brown loafers, sat in the middle of a front row bench next to his wife and lawyer. Large pink marble columns stretched up toward a beamed ceiling with an intricate maroon and yellow pattern. A large oak desk rested in the front of the room, facing 15 smaller oak desks assigned to each alderperson and spaced several feet apart. The night before, the lawyer had submitted an addendum to the council. It came in too late for most alders to read, so the lawyer stood and cleared his throat. The addendum, he informed the room, included 10 steps Tobin would take in the immediate and near future. He would enroll in a day-long landlord training class offered by the city, hire a 24-hour security service and an independent management company, evict nuisance tenants, and address the property code violations. He would not retaliate against tenants who spoke out against him, and he would sell the trailer park within a year. "The people in this park are vulnerable. Elderly, disabled, children," the lawyer concluded, noting that Tobin had worked diligently with Alderman Witkowski to draw up the terms of the agreement. The Common Council was not happy with this midnight deal, and they argued with one another as sunlight beamed through the chamber's stained glass windows. One alderman called it a gentleman's agreement. Another asked if all citizens, when called to account, could simply produce a 10-point plan. Finally, Alderman Witkowski rose to speak. "Mr. Charney has allowed a good mobile home park to move to something like this," he began. "I have 4 mobile home parks in my district, and this is the only one with these types of problems." He looked over his glasses at the lawyer. "They aren't all elderly, disabled, and children, sir, but," he turned back to his colleagues, "there are people with limited means and limited abilities. They would be forced to move out." Witkowski was no friend of Tobin's, but he was satisfied with the terms of the addendum. The debate rose up again, energetic and sharp. Tobin remained seated in the back, holding his wife's hand and looking annoyed. The president called for a vote. After the hearing, Tobin drove to the trailer park. He did not call everyone together to announce the resolution. He did not slide into a chair in the office and let out a sigh. He began evictions. The council had agreed to let Tobin keep his license only if he took drastic steps to improve the park, including forcing the troublemakers out. When city or state officials pressured landlords by ordering them to hire an outside security firm or by having a building inspector scrutinize their property, landlords often passed the pressure onto their tenants. There was also the matter of reestablishing control. The most effective way to assert or reassert ownership of land was to force people from it.
"Where did my 28-day notices go?" Lenny asked.
He was in the office, searching through piles of papers. With a 28-day no-cause termination notice, landlords did not need to provide a reason for the eviction. It was an ideal way to remove nuisance tenants who were current on their rent. Turning to Tobin, he said,
"You got a lot of 28-day notices to fill out." "They owe me back rent," Tobin replied. "Give them a 5-day.
They, in this case, meant Pam and her family. After driving Pam to eviction court, Tobin had asked her to talk to the news people. She was 30 years old and 7 months pregnant, with a Midwestern twang and a face cut from a high school yearbook photo. She made for a sympathetic case. But now Tobin was cleaning house. Tobin looked up.
"Lenny, I hope the money isn't coming in slow because of this," he said. "It's not, surprisingly," Lenny replied. "I just filled out my spreadsheets and we're looking good."
Office Susie added, "I had a beautiful collection."
Pam tried changing Tobin's mind by signing over the $1,200 check she had just received as part of Obama's Economic Stimulus Act. She thought it would be enough, mainly because she thought she owed $1,800. But Tobin said she owed something more like $3,000, and Office Susie told him Pam smoked crack. Tobin accepted Pam's stimulus check, but moved forward with the eviction anyway. Pam's family had lived in the trailer park for 2 years. Pam and her boyfriend, Ned Kroll, ended up in one of Tobin's trailers because he gave it to them. Pam and Ned had been considering moving to Milwaukee from Green Bay to be closer to Pam's ailing father when they spotted an ad Tobin had taken out in the local paper. They drove down to have a look. When Pam and Ned arrived at College Mobile Home Park, Tobin and Lenny offered them the Handyman Special, a free mobile home. Under this arrangement, tenants owned the trailers, and Tobin owned the ground underneath them. He charged the owners lot rent, which was equivalent to what his renters paid. But unlike the renters, families who owned their trailers were responsible for upkeep. In theory, a family could at any time move their trailer elsewhere, but the owners knew that in practice this was impossible. Towing expenses exceed $1,500, and setting up the trailer somewhere else could cost double that. When owners were evicted and inevitably left their trailer behind, Tobin would reclaim it as abandoned property and give it to someone else. At the time that Pam was facing eviction, all but 20 trailers in the park were owner-occupied. The only benefit to owning your trailer was psychological. "I moved here so I can own a home, even if it's on wheels," one of Pam's neighbors liked to say. Tobin's mobile home giveaways sped things up. He could fill recently vacated trailers, sometimes even junk trailers, in weeks, if not days. But hard-up families found the trailer park on their own, too. In Milwaukee and cities across the country, as affordable rental stock has been allowed to deteriorate and eventually disappear, low-income families have rushed to occupy cheap units. Nationwide, vacancy rates for low-cost units have fallen to single digits. Lenny's office phone rang daily with people inquiring about availability. The phone rang before the news people came, and it rang after they left. The month the story aired, the trailer park had zero vacancies.
"The park is filled up," Lenny said with a chuckle. "And we still got people calling."
The rent rolls that Lenny kept for Tobin showed that in an average month, only 5 trailers sat vacant, which would put Tobin's vacancy rate below 4%. The high demand for the cheapest housing told landlords that for every family in a unit, there were scores behind them ready to take their place. In such an environment, the incentive to lower the rent, forgive a late payment, or spruce up your property was extremely low.
"Figures," Ned had mumbled past a dangling cigarette when he found out Pam was pregnant with another daughter. He had made a son once, when he was 16, with a Mexican girl he'd met at a ZZ Top concert, but the girl's family blotted him out, and Ned hardly thought about that boy anymore, unless LaGrange came on the radio. "After that, maybe I got punished," he once mused. "No more boys." The new one would make 5 daughters if you counted Pam's 2 black girls, which Ned sometimes did. Pam and Ned had met in Green Bay after Pam's father asked Ned to tune up his Harley. Ned was 10 years older than Pam, with grease under his fingernails, brown stubble, and long hair, balding in the front. He was the kind of man who took satisfaction in leaving the bathroom door open and scratching himself in public. Pam already had 2 daughters, Bliss, born when Pam was 23, and Sandra, 2 years after that. Their father, a black man, was a drug dealer whom Pam had met when she was 19. Pam later learned that she was one of several girlfriends.
"Tell about the time that Dad hit you with a bottle and blood was coming out of your head," Sandra once asked her mother as they drove to a food pantry. She was 6 when she said this. Pam forced a sad smile.
"You weren't old enough to remember that."
"Yes, I was," replied Sandra.
Sandra was the one who would squash a cockroach with a loose shoe while the other girls shuddered and clung to one another. She and Bliss were the only black children in the trailer park. Once, one of their neighbors hung a Nazi flag in his front window. Lenny didn't permit that, but he was okay with the Confederate flag, as long as it was displayed underneath Old Glory.
No, you were just a baby.
Now, Bliss, she was. She got so used to it. She always saw blood just pour out of me. Pam found a way to leave him. She began working as a certified nursing assistant, emptying bedpans, mopping up puke, and rotating the invalids to prevent bed sores. She learned how to cook pots of spaghetti and macaroni salad. Her mother had died in a car accident when Pam was in high school, and had never got around to teaching her. Her father hadn't either. He spent a lot of time in prison on drug and drunk driving charges. Pam's brother was doing better, too. He was taking methadone and said he didn't miss heroin. It was a time of promise and rebirth, a time of putting one foot steadily in front of the other. Then the ground shifted beneath. One day, Pam answered the phone. A voice was saying that her brother was dead. Pam asked how. The voice said, overdose. He was 29. Pam screamed into the phone. Then she hung up and dialed another number to ask for something to keep her from drowning. The words to describe the drug, crack, rock, gave off the impression that it was a gnarled, craggy thing. But when you held it in your hand, it could be smooth and elegant. It could look like a piece of Chiclets gum, the kind that slides into a child's cupped hand out of the quarter-turn machine. All those years with the drug dealer, Pam had stayed away from it. She saw how it turned people, saw what they would do for it. But she also saw the way it helped people forget. There was not a day that went by that I wasn't fucked up on something, Pam remembered. And sometimes I'd be like, wow, I haven't even cried for him yet. But I didn't. Before I would, I'd go and get high. That's when she met Ned. That first year, crack was the force that held them together. They lived for it and by it, raising the girls along the way. Soon, they began selling it. A year after meeting, they were caught and convicted. Ned, who had a previous drug charge, did prison time. It was Pam's first felony. She was sentenced to 4 years probation and made to sit for 10 months in a jail cell, where, finally, she cried. When Pam got out, she tried to stay sober. She moved in with the straightest friend she knew in Green Bay. But while Pam was in jail, the friend had developed a habit. Everybody I know in fucking Green Bay is fucking on dope, Pam vented. She asked her father to wire her $500 so she could move, and, to her surprise, he did. But Green Bay was a small town, and Pam soon crossed paths with one of her former dealers. He got me hooked right back on. Pam and Ned reconnected after he was released, and Pam soon discovered she was pregnant. Ned demanded a paternity test, which confirmed the baby was his. They settled on a name, Kristen. Soon, Ned's daughter from another woman came to live with them. Laura had a small nose and freckles and was 1 year older than Bliss. A few months after Laura moved in, Ned left her, Pam, and the other girls with a woman they had just met in the drug scene. Pam and the girls spent the night at the woman's house, then the next night, and the night after that. Pam eventually walked Laura to her mother's house and knocked on the door. She remembered standing at the door and telling Laura's mother, I'm about to have this baby. I'm homeless right now. Your old man left me. I have no money, no food, no nothing for your kid. I'm scared. Can you please take your daughter? Laura's mother stayed on the phone, gave them a bag of canned food, and shut the door. Pam and the girls stayed at the woman's house. Ned came back a month later. When Tobin told Pam and Ned he was keeping their rebate check and still evicting them, he brought along a security detail. But nobody caused a scene, even though Tobin only gave them 24 hours to leave before he called the sheriff. Ned might have raised hell if he didn't have an outstanding warrant for his arrest, stemming from another drug charge. Pam and Ned blamed each other for the eviction.
You cracked it up, Ned snapped at Pam.
You cracked it up, Pam shot back. Talking about me, I handed you all the money. You got us evicted.
Move, bitch.
It's you, Ned.
You can move.
I can't. It's you. Pam stopped. I don't know. Is it really me? Is it me who has the problem? I don't know. Maybe it is.
Am I the one that fucked up?
They sold their only possessions worth anything, the television and the computer, Pam's Christmas gift. They would need the extra cash. Each month, Pam worked 30 hours a week for her welfare check of $673 and received $390 in food stamps. On a good day, Ned brought in $50 cash for customizing and repairing motorcycles. Pam's money was Pam's money, and Ned's was Ned's. They kept separate bank accounts and split the bills down the middle. After jail, Pam had had a difficult time finding work with her recent drug conviction. She finally was hired by Quad Graphics, a commercial printing plant. Quad had a reputation for hiring people with records and without high school diplomas, provided they were willing to work the third shift. Pam was. She ran the warm, humming machines from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. Quad Graphics was in Sussex, a 40-minute drive from the trailer park. Pam relished the commute. It was her time, time away from Ned and the kids. Then her car gave out at the worst time, winter, when money was tightest. Ned had been working with the construction crew, which all but shut down in the colder months. They didn't have enough money to repair the car, and Pam lost her job. That's when they fell behind with Tobin. Emergency assistance got them through 1 month. A couple months later, in February, Pam gave Tobin $1,000 that she received from her tax refund. But they were still in the red. Pam could have given Tobin more, but she wanted to get back to Quad, which meant she needed a car. She bought one for $400, but a week later, Ned heard a clicking sound and told Pam to offload it before the engine threw a rod. And a lot of money went to dope. There were mornings when Pam would come home from working the third shift to find Ned at Heroin Susie's or wide awake in the living room on the tail end of an all-night bender with women passed out on the couch. There were evenings when Pam got so high, she couldn't walk. The computer and television sold, the rest of their things shoved into garbage bags. Pam walked across the row and asked Scott if she and her family could stay with him until they got back on their feet. Or at least until the baby came. Scott was a heroin user, approaching 40. He lived with Teddy, an older man he had met when both were staying at the lodge. Pam trusted them around the girls, even if Scott did pass out in front of them once. Scott and Teddy said yes and didn't even ask for money. Tobin huffed when Office Susie told him that Pam and Ned were staying with Scott and Teddy. He had agreed to rent Scott and Teddy's trailer to Scott and Teddy, nobody else. Tobin gave Scott and Teddy an eviction notice, tacking on Pam and Ned's rental debt to Scott and Teddy's bill. Eviction could be contagious that way. 5. 13th Street. Arlene didn't mind 13th Street. There was a bodega owned by Arabs on one end of her block, and a bar for old men on the other. She could walk Jafaris to school. Arlene could have done without the hypes, crack addicts, who had recently moved into the abandoned house next door. But a few more houses down, a girl was learning to play the violin. Her new apartment was coming along, too. There was a time when the house was a stately thing, built in Greek Revival style. It was two stories of sandstone block with twin columns supporting an awning over the front door. A pair of picture-frame windows adorned with peaked pediments faced the street, as did a larger second-story window whose pane opened on hinges. But over the years, the house had deteriorated. One column base was settling, causing the overhead awning to slope sideways. The columns, porch, and window pediments had been painted ash gray, and an imposing iron-barred outer door had been installed. Arlene didn't like walking up the front steps, with their flaking paint and mismatched stair rails on either side, so she always used the side entrance. Arlene had thrown herself into making the apartment a home. The previous tenants had left behind a large armoire, a bedroom dresser, a bed, and a refrigerator. There was even more in the basement. Dishes, clothes, an upholstered chair. Arlene put it all to use, rearranging the furniture and stacking the dishes next to her nice porcelain plates, the ones she had been given years ago by a domestic violence shelter. She claimed the front bedroom and gave the boys the one in the back, placing their twin mattresses on the ground and organizing clothes in dresser drawers. She unpacked a stereo and listened to old-school hip-hop tracks on burned CDs, her favorite being Tupac's Keep Your Head Up. In the kitchen, she hung a humble drawing of black farmers hoeing a row.
Over the bathroom door, she affixed a sign that she had found at a drugstore. "Today worried you yesterday, and all is well." In the basement, Arlene had also come across rollers, brushes, and a 5-gallon bucket of white paint. She lugged everything upstairs, tied a wrap around her head, and gave the walls a fresh coat. She went ahead and painted the stairwell leading to the upstairs unit, too. The job complete, she lit a stick of incense to mask the paint smell and looked around. She felt pleased with herself, content. The days passed, and Arlene and her boys settled into their new home. After school, Jory sometimes challenged other neighborhood boys to a game of cans, Jafaris looking on. Using a basketball, Jory and his competitor tried to hit soda cans flattened on the sidewalk, earning more points for farther shots. He was a lanky boy, whose arms and fingers seemed to be growing faster than the rest of him, a condition he tried to conceal under oversized sweatshirts and coats. He wore his hair natural and had a relaxed, agreeable way about him. But Jory was fiercely loyal to his mama. If Arlene needed to smile, Jory would steal for her. If she was disrespected, he would fight for her. Some kids born into poverty set their sights on doing whatever it takes to get out. Jory wasn't going anywhere, sensing he was put on this earth to look after Arlene and Jafaris. He was, all 14 years of him, the man of the house. Jafaris was a big kid, the biggest in his kindergarten class. While Jory was all knees and elbows, Jafaris had a round chest and defined shoulders, with high cheekbones and cornrows that always needed redoing. When Jafaris grew bored, he would scavenge the basement or back alley for anything he could find, mop handles, rusted tools, dog leashes, pieces of plywood, and pretend they were tanks and helicopters locked in battle. After dinner, Arlene would watch reruns with the volume turned low, or read through Jafaris's individualized education program, IEP evaluations, or flip through her prayer book. Some nights, she climbed the stairs and opened the upper unit's unlocked door to give herself a little privacy. Arlene liked that the upstairs unit was vacant. She preferred things quiet. One day, a friend gave Arlene a cat, a half-black, half-white thing. After Sharina said they could keep it, Jory named him Little and began feeding him table scraps. Jory laughed when Little would spring at a loose shoelace or gulp down a ramen noodle. Jafaris would pick him up and press his nose against his ear. Both boys especially loved it when Little caught a mouse. He would drag the thing to the middle of the room and smack it around. The mouse would take different routes, trying to figure out what Little wanted. Bat, bat. The mouse would tumble and roll with every swat. At some point, the pathetic creature would burrow under Little's arm, hiding. Little would let the mouse rest and warm itself. Then he might reach down and grab the creature with his mouth and throw it into the air and, enjoying the effect, do it again and again. Eventually, the mouse would just lie there motionless, and Little would look at it with cool disgust, wondering why the creature didn't get back up. Jory opened the door and called out, "You having an asthma attack?" Jory had walked Jafaris home from school. Arlene stayed on the love seat waiting to see how bad it was. When it was a small attack, Jafaris's mouth opened and closed like a caught fish. When it was a medium attack, he made an O with his mouth. When it was bad, his lips curled back, and he breathed through his nubby teeth. Jafaris walked through the door making the O face. He shrugged off his backpack and leaned on the love seat like an old man after climbing a flight of stairs. "Jafaris, go get me my bag," Arlene said. The boy nodded and went to the bedroom. When he came back, Arlene pulled out the albuterol and shook it. Jafaris put his mouth to the inhaler and breathed in. But their timing was off. "Blow it out. Don't be playing with me," Arlene snapped. Jafaris missed the next try, too, but the third filled his lungs. He held his breath, puffing out his cheeks the way children do before jumping into a pool. His mother counted. 1, 2, 3. At 10, Jafaris exhaled, took a breath in, and smiled. Arlene smiled back. She gave Jafaris albuterol every morning and every evening. Before bed, he got prednisone, a steroid, through a Pari ProNeb Ultra nebulizer with plastic tubing and an airplane cabin mask.
Arlene called it the breathing machine. Jafaris's asthma had been improving. Arlene remembered when she used to rush Jafaris to the hospital every week. Jafaris's father had given him his name, and lately Arlene had been worried he might have given him other things, too. His father had learning disabilities and anger issues, and Jafaris was beginning to exhibit similar characteristics at school. He excelled at reading, but struggled with other subjects, and he pushed his classmates around. He had been evaluated, but didn't qualify for additional help. Some teachers had suggested medications, which made Arlene bristle. "I don't like medicine. I'm totally against Ritalin. I think he needs more one-on-one attention. I don't want to medicate him unless he's seen a counselor and done gone through that." Arlene had met Jafaris's father at the movie theater at the Mayfair Mall, where she was working the concession stand. "It just kind of happened," Arlene recalled. "We weren't in no real relationship." They tried for one, but Arlene discovered he could be a violent man. He went to prison soon after she left him. He gave Jafaris little else beyond life. It had been the same way with Arlene's father. He had left after impregnating her mother, who was only 16 when she had Arlene. Arlene's grandmother served food in the cafeteria at Columbia St. Mary's Hospital, but her mother rarely worked outside the home. She received assistance and later married a man who held down a job. That man became a minister, which was the reason Arlene tried never to set foot in a church. When Arlene moved out at 17, she threw away the hand-me-down clothes her mother had made her wear to school. "Ding dong," her classmates would taunt when she walked past in recycled bell-bottoms. Arlene put rubber bands on the bottom of her jeans, but that only made the kids laugh harder. When she dropped out before finishing high school, her mother said nothing. She didn't care. Arlene moved in with a family that paid her to babysit their children. During that time, she met the man who would become the father of her eldest child, Gerald, whom she took to calling Jer-Jer. After Arlene discovered she was pregnant with Jer-Jer, her man got entangled with the law. "I didn't know nothing about having a boyfriend in and out of jail all the time. So when I met somebody else," during one of the times Jer-Jer's father was locked up, "I just left him alone." That someone else was Larry. He was a lean man with calm eyes and a wide brow. Larry had taught himself how to be a mechanic and earned money fixing cars in a back alley. On paydays, he would take Arlene out for Chinese food, her favorite. She would read the long menu but order the same thing every time. Sesame chicken. They were poor and in love, and soon Arlene was pregnant with another son. They named him after Larry, but called him Boosie. Larry and Arlene had three more children after that, a daughter and two more sons, letting Arlene's mother name their youngest, Jory. They liked it. "Will you marry me?" Larry asked one day. Arlene laughed. She thought he was joking and said no. He wasn't talking about no big marriage, wasn't even talking about at the courthouse, Arlene remembered. But he was not joking. When she realized this, Arlene dropped her smile and said she would have to think about it. What gave her pause was not Larry, but his mother and sister. "They always thought they knew more. I was never good enough in their eyes." After that, Larry started running around. It crushed Arlene, but when he came back, she always held the door open. Until one day, he didn't come back. They had been together for 7 years. This time, the other woman was someone Arlene considered a friend. That happened years ago. Sometimes, Larry parked outside of where Arlene was staying. She'd climb in his van, and they'd drive around and talk, mostly about Jory. From time to time, Larry took Jory to church or let him spend the night or swelled his lip for getting in trouble at school. When Jory spotted Larry driving by in the neighborhood, he'd holler, "There go my daddy," and run after him. When Larry walked out on her and the kids, Arlene was working at the Mainstay Suites by the airport. In despair, she quit and began relying on welfare. Sometime later, she found work cleaning the Third Street Pier restaurant, but then her mother died suddenly. The grief overwhelmed her, and she left that job, too. She later regretted going back on welfare, but it was a dark time. When she moved onto 13th Street, Arlene was receiving W-2T. Owing mainly to her chronic depression, she received the same stipend in 2008 that she would have when welfare was reformed over a decade earlier. $20.65 a day, $7,536 a year. Since 1997, welfare stipends in Milwaukee and almost everywhere else have not budged, even as housing costs have soared. For years, politicians have known that families could not survive on welfare alone. This was the case before rent and utility costs climbed throughout the 2000s, and it was even more true afterward. Arlene had given up hoping for housing assistance long ago. If she had a housing voucher or a key to a public housing unit, she would spend only 30% of her income on rent. It would mean the difference between stable poverty and grinding poverty, the difference between planting roots in a community and being batted from one place to another. It would mean she could give most of her check to her children instead of her landlord. Years ago, when she was 19, Arlene rented a subsidized apartment for $137 a month. She had just had Jer-Jer and was grateful to be out of her mother's house. She could make her own decisions. So, when a friend asked Arlene to give up her place and move in with her, Arlene decided to say yes. She walked away from a subsidized apartment and into the private rental market, where she would stay for the next 20 years. "I thought it was okay to move somewhere else," she remembered. "And I regret it, right now to this day." "Young," she shook her head at her 19-year-old self. "If I would have been in my right mind, I could have still been there." One day, on a whim, Arlene stopped by the housing authority and asked about the list. A woman behind the glass told her, "The list is frozen." On it were over 3,500 families who had applied for rent assistance 4 years earlier. Arlene nodded and left with hands in her pockets. It could have been worse. In larger cities like Washington, D.C., the wait for public housing was counted in decades. In those cities, a mother of a young child who put her name on the list might be a grandmother by the time her application was reviewed. Most poor people in America were like Arlene. They did not live in public housing or apartments subsidized by vouchers. 3 in 4 families who qualified for assistance received nothing. If Arlene wanted public housing, she would have to save a month's worth of income to repay the housing authority for leaving her subsidized apartment without giving notice. Then wait 2 to 3 years until the list unfroze. Then wait another 2 to 5 years until her application made it to the top of the pile. Then pray to Jesus that the person with the stale coffee and heavy stamp reviewing her file would somehow overlook the eviction record she'd collected while trying to make ends meet in the private housing market on a welfare check. The upstairs unit on 13th Street didn't sit vacant for long. Sharina moved a young woman into the apartment soon after the paint had dried on Arlene's walls. Tricia was her name. Arlene and Tricia began talking and sharing meals. Arlene could be quiet and cautious around new people, guarded. But Tricia was an open book. She told Arlene that this was her first real home in 8 years. Her last real home belonged to her sister, who had asked her to leave after Tricia told her what their father had done to her. Tricia then started sleeping in shelters and abandoned houses, but mostly she went home with men. At 16, she learned to use her skinny frame, her flush of wavy black hair, her copper skin, a mix of black, Mexican, and white blood. The year before, when she was 23, Tricia had had a baby but signed him over to her sister because she was using crack, mostly. After the baby came, Tricia found Repairers of the Breach, a local homeless outreach that helped her get on SSI. Tricia was illiterate and fragile. Jory once reduced her to tears by asking, "You special or something?" But she was also laid back and sweet. Most of all, she was there. When Arlene and Tricia wanted a smoke to stave off boredom or, at the end of the month, hunger, Tricia used spare change to buy loose cigarettes at the corner store or fished stubs from standing ashtrays outside of fast food joints. When Arlene needed to run an errand, Tricia would watch the boys, and Jory, who saw Tricia as an equal or a lesser, but certainly not as an adult, would tell her to watch her mouth around Jafaris. "I was born to be cussing," Tricia would reply. One day, Arlene and Tricia watched a U-Haul truck pull up. 3 women and a man walked up to the apartment and gave Arlene's door a knock. Sensing who they were, Arlene cracked the door and wedged her leg and foot behind it in case they tried to push through. A young woman introduced herself as the previous tenant and said she had come to collect her things. The armoire, dresser, and refrigerator all belonged to her. Arlene told the young woman that Sharina had thrown everything out. The woman looked doubtful, but Tricia backed her up. The previous tenant and her people left before discovering the lie. Once they were gone, Arlene and Tricia nodded at each other. After that, Tricia took to telling people that the women were old friends, that they had met outside a corner store years ago, when Tricia was just a girl, and Arlene had told her, "You a pretty female." There was more to the story, about Arlene meeting Tricia's mother in prison, about Tricia waking up in the hospital and Arlene being there, but it was all in Tricia's head. It was hard to know if she believed it or not. Tricia came to Sharina through Belinda Hall, who was the best thing to happen to Sharina in a long time. A black woman, not yet 30, with a round face and glasses, Belinda ran her own business, working as a representative payee responsible for handling the finances of SSI beneficiaries found incapable of managing on their own. Sharina liked finding tenants through social service agencies, which often vouched for tenants and put up some cash. But Belinda was a special catch. "I've been helping this girl as much as possible because I want her to fill up my properties," Sharina reflected. "The rent comes directly from her every month, so that's a damn good situation to be in." Sharina told Belinda that she would empty out all of her units if she wanted them for her clients. "I'm serious, because I know I would get my money." Tricia was the fourth tenant Belinda had given Sharina since the two women had met 3 months earlier. Those poor and disabled enough to receive SSI, but not clean enough to be welcomed into public housing, made up Belinda's client base. Belinda estimated that rent payments took between 60% and 70% of her typical client's monthly income. Many clients had little left over after Belinda paid for rent, utilities, and food. Because stable and affordable housing was a major problem for Belinda's clients, she cultivated friendships with landlords, whom she could then call upon in an emergency. Belinda once phoned Sharina around 5 a.m. because the heat in one of her clients' buildings had gone out, and she needed to relocate her that day. The faster Belinda could address clients' housing problems, the more clients she could take on, and the more money she could make. Belinda charged each client $37 a month for her services. When she met Sharina, Belinda had 230 clients. What Belinda could offer Sharina and other landlords was steady, reliable rental income. And what Belinda got in return was a growing customer base, which meant more money in her pocket. Press 1 to leave a voice message. Sharina pressed 1. "Arlene, this is Sharina calling. I'm calling to find out if you had your rent. Remember we agreed that you were going to pay a little bit over to get caught up with the $320 you owed for..." Sharina stopped herself from finishing the sentence with, "your sister's funeral costs." She went on, "I will be expecting the $650. Go ahead and give me a call." Arlene didn't regret what she had done. Usually, when there was a funeral, she couldn't even afford to buy Jafaris new shoes and would just scrub his best ones. She had missed funerals in the past because Jory and Jafaris didn't have anything to wear. But this was her sister. Not in the biological sense, but in the spiritual sense. They were close. She had long been a sickly girl, overweight and diabetic. Her heart quit after she'd been hospitalized for pneumonia and a series of other health complications. Arlene didn't have the money, but neither did anyone else. She would have been ashamed of herself if she hadn't pitched in. She gave half of her check to Sharina and the other half to New Pitts Mortuary. Sharina felt bad when she heard about Arlene's sister. She made her new tenant a deal. Arlene could stay if she paid $650 for 3 months to recover the lost rent. Even if Arlene signed over her entire welfare check each month, she would still be short. But Sharina was betting that Arlene could put in a few calls to family members or nonprofit agencies. Arlene took the deal because she had no other option. Sharina and Quentin were in the suburban when Arlene called around the beginning of the next month. Sharina hung up and looked at Quentin. "Arlene said her check didn't come." This was a half-truth. Arlene had received a check, but not for $628. She had missed an appointment with her welfare caseworker, completely forgetting about it. A reminder notice was mailed to Atkinson, or was it 19th Street? When Arlene didn't show, the caseworker